Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm Julie Cummins of the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, and I want to welcome you to tonight's meeting of InForum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. Tonight's event is co-presented by LitQuake, San Francisco's literary festival, and the club's Good Lit program, and we'll be talking about the politics of food, what we eat, and why it matters. Food is rapidly becoming one of the most politicized commodities in America. From giant agribusiness to genetically modified foods to Walmart's push into organics, what we put in our mouths and how it affects our bodies and the earth is a red button issue in the 21st century. Our panel of journalists and food activists will discuss the politics of food from many angles. Let me introduce our panel. Ignacio Chapela is a microbial ecologist and mycologist at UC Berkeley and an outspoken critic of the university's ties to the biotechnology industry. Chapela founded the Mycological Facility, dealing with questions of natural resources and the rights of indigenous communities. Christopher D. Cook is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of Diet for a Dead Planet, Big Business and the Coming Food Crisis. He has written for Harper's, The Economist, The Christian Science Monitor, and other publications, and is a member of the San Francisco Writers Grotto. Bryant Terry is a Whole Foods chef, food justice activist, and co-author of Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen with Anna LaPay, and a foreword by Eric Schlosser. Bryant and his recipes have been featured in the New York Times, Gourmet, Food and Wine, and other publications. Michelle Simon is a public health lawyer and director of the Center for Informed Food Choices. She teaches at UC Hastings and has published many articles about food industry tactics. Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back is her first book. So now I will move on to questions. This is a very broad topic that we're addressing tonight. Food politics is a complex web of interrelated issues, but we'll try to cover as much as we can in the next hour. So I'd like to start out with a general question for each of our panelists, and that is, what food-related issue or issues are you most concerned about and why? So let's start with Ignacio Chapela.
I get to start. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming out tonight. To me, the key word tonight is the word control. On the one hand, we have an agricultural system that continues to be concentrated and controlled tightly, more and more tightly, by a fewer and fewer hands. So losing control of what we eat, losing control of what we grow, what our landscapes hold, to me is a very important question. The other side of that coin is the reverse, and that is the loss of control over the biological nature of this agriculture, this food system that we are creating or we are living off today. We continue to push an ecological system that requires a whole set of relationships to operate to a place where we really do not have control. We are sold the idea of control. We are sold the idea that we really have are doing something, that we know what we're doing, and yet the biological system that we're playing with is one that continues to get out of our control. So these two sides, these two reverse sides of the same coin, to me, will be the central word for my concern tonight, and I think it's a central word for my work in the last few years.
Thank you. Christopher Cook?
Thank you very much. I'm going to try not to sound like an echo of those remarks, but I agree. from a slightly different standpoint, I think that political and economic control over our food system that has become incredibly concentrated into just a few corporations is the critical aspect that drives so many of the sub-issues that we deal with when we look at food today, when we look at the various health effects of, ranging from obesity and type 2 diabetes to various cancers rising up, to environmental devastation from large-scale factory farming, to extreme, very severe, intense labor abuse of workers in the food system, to the demise of farmers and small and mid-sized farmers who are rapidly becoming extinct in America. All of this I see, and I've researched this quite a bit, is driven by the corporate sort of domination of the food system to the extent that now just a few corporations control more than half of most of the major foodstuffs in America today and most of the supermarkets in this country. And they drive an entire system of economic rationalities that requires this sort of cheap food at all costs system that ends up being not so cheap after all.
Great. Thank you. Bryant Terry.
Thank you. I have to say that the focus of my work and the focus that my work has focused since 2001 has been on diet-related illnesses. And I came into this work because of my understanding of the lack of access to healthy food in low-income communities and the way in which it is affecting the health of young people in particular. But recently, my focus has turned to the South, the southern region of the United States, because I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and although I haven't lived there in a while, the statistics are clear that this is a region that needs a lot of attention. I recently found out that in Mississippi, one out of three people are obese, regardless of race or socioeconomic status. Alabama is the number one, the state with the highest rate of obesity in the United States, and so many of the states are suffering from this increased rates of obesity and then the exponential rise in a lot of diet-related illnesses. So my focus is going to be on the South, and I think understanding lack of access to healthy food as a form of oppression and the way in which so many marginalized communities are suffering in so many ways, but particularly with the way that they're eating. And as a chef, I have to say that, this is one of the most tangible, immediate ways that we can think about transforming the food system, given that food is such a political act.
Thank you. Michelle Simon.
Thanks. So disadvantage of going last is that everyone else has said all the great stuff. My original answer was going to be corporate control of the food supply, and I do think that is the underlying cause of all of the ill effects we're seeing, which are essentially symptoms. So when we talk about the pollution caused by factory farming, when we talk about the ill effects from labor practices, and when we talk about E. coli poisoning, which we're hearing a lot of in the news lately, these are all symptoms of the underlying problem, which is corporate control of the food supply and profit motive, which is taking place over the values that we as a society would like to see in our food system, values like health, nutrition, sustainability, good labor practices, animal welfare, et cetera. These are all values that are taking, are getting shifted aside because of profit motive. And I think that's something that we really need to look at because otherwise we just keep kind of spinning our wheels, looking at each symptom in isolation. My concern that I address mainly in my book is this idea that we've lost a sense of what food is, and because our food is so heavily processed, I mean, young people today grow up thinking food is, Oreos and Big Macs, and that kind of food bears no resemblance to food that comes from nature, which is how humans evolved. So that's sort of my underlying theme as far as the nutrition message goes, is that we need to be eating food that comes from nature the way humans are meant to eat it, not what the food companies have turned food into, which is highly processed, highly unhealthy, unsustainable food.
Well, you brought up a very current issue when you mentioned the E. coli, and I don't think we can get through this whole panel without talking about it. So let's just start off with a question about that. There's been a lot of concern in the media lately and across the country about food safety, and in addition to the E. coli that happened in the bagged spinach and the deaths and illnesses associated with that, we've also had, just within the last month, heard about E. coli in raw milk, E. coli in beef. Lettuce was voluntarily recalled recently. So do you think our food is generally safe, or do you think there's a real problem here that we need to be concerned about? And if so, what should we do to address the problem? This might be for Michelle or Christopher. You guys can decide who to answer.
You want to go first?
Okay. I think a couple issues come up in this case, which has clearly not been totally resolved yet as to the exact cause. But the more the news reports come out, the more clear it becomes that this is an aspect of the centralization of food production and long-distance shipping and the mixing of various foodstuffs from various farms, but also just from large-scale farms, being funneled into a national food distribution complex, which we see so disastrously and much more commonly in meat, which is the highest portion of these foodborne illnesses comes in meat. And experts have shown that this is paralleling the concentration of meat production from the farming to the processing, adding to the likelihood of these virulent bacterial strains arising and then metastasizing in the food system. And then the other thing that comes up in this whole situation is that time and time again, the government has proved to be late and ineffectual in dealing with these cases. I think it's been at least 2 weeks between when the FDA was notified of a problem and when they made it public. Now, in many of the meat recalls over the past several years, we have not even, as a public, been able to know where that tainted beef goes to, because the companies are allowed to keep that private. So there are all these aspects of production which are considered, and marketing, which are, you know, said to be proprietary and which end up withholding information from public agencies and withholding it from the public. And I think that's a serious area that needs a lot of attention in this discussion. So it's not just about one field of tainted spinach. And the last little bit I'll throw into that mix clearly also connects with the factory farming issue of these massive facilities that, you know, pack together tens of thousands of animals and produce phenomenal amounts of waste. And although they haven't exactly connected this case yet with factory farm runoff, it's E. coli in the irrigation waters. Tests are showing it might be E. coli from nearby cattle operations. They don't know yet. But this is a major problem across the country, even if it's not tied to this particular case. And it's really a sort of a ticking time bomb. So
Well, I would just add, my concern is in how the media has been responding to it. And it's sort of typical, you know, your local news scaremongering, but not asking the hard questions about, you know, where is this coming from? And it's, you know, we're pretty certain that factory farming certainly plays a role, even if we're not able to scientifically prove cause and effect. I mean, you know, E. coli comes from animal manure because of the way animals are housed so closely together, and because cattle in particular are fed corn, which makes their stomachs acidified, and that breeds E. coli. So, I mean, we need to really be asking, we need to be going back several steps in the food production process to say, why is this happening? And we shouldn't be looking to Band-Aid solutions like irradiation, which is a typical solution when we talk about how to clean up meat, right? I mean, that's just technology on top of technology instead of getting at the underlying cause and rethinking the way we're producing food. So I would like to see that conversation happening in media more than just scaring people about don't eat spinach.
Another topic that we've heard about in the news recently is genetically modified organisms. You may have heard about the announcement in August that the United States supply of long grain rice was contaminated with a genetically engineered variety that had not been approved for human consumption, and consequently, some countries decided to boycott U.S. rice, and it's become a pretty big issue. So my question is this. If if consumers don't want genetically modified food and the countries who are importing our food don't want genetically modified food and farmers, the rice farmers were opposed to genetically modified rice varieties being grown in this country. So if all of those cases are true, then why is it still being used? And what do you think about genetically modified, what do you think about genetically modifying our food? I think this is a question for Ignacio Chapela.
Well, big question again. So it's an opportunity really to talk about this whole area, but if you ask why it is, I think you're right. Every poll that we run or anybody runs shows that approximately 70, 80, 90% of the public in general doesn't want, given a choice, people don't want genetic engineering in their food for whatever reason. In Europe, it's a little bit more exacerbated than here, mostly because people know more about it, because it gets a lot more media coverage and so on. So I think you're right in general. So starting from that point, the question is why? Why did we go into this, and why do we not have the capacity to step back and say, wait a minute, it seems as though we're not really happy about this. What can we reconsider? The truth is that, and the reason why we're there, is because we bought into it at a very, very, very central place. We decided on it many years ago, decades ago. The genetic engineering experiment, if you want to call it that, has been going on for more than 30 years, already in the field. And we bought into it as a possible replacement of computer information, material sciences as the locomotive of the economy for this country as well as the economy of the world. We live in this place where we have seen enormous economic development coming out of technology and the application of technology to industry. And back then, back in the 1970s already, it was very clear that those technologies were going to go following the usual path, which is following lower standards, environmental standards, lower labor standards. So it made sense back then, at a very central place, to say we need a replacement technology. The same people who advised central governments, central decision makers about what ended up being cell phones and computers and so on, advised the same thing. They said, put your eggs in this basket. Biotechnology will be it. So 30 years later, 35 years later, $350 billion, that's more or less the investment 2 years ago estimated, into this venture. It's very difficult to call it back and say, you know, it didn't work. It ain't the PC. When PC could have turned into not personal computer, but personal cloner, it really hasn't happened. And I don't think it will happen, mostly because people don't want it. So it's very difficult, mostly because we've bought into it as a national cultural project rather than a simple technological development.
Let me ask a follow-up question, which is, can you see any positive ways that we could use the technology of genetic engineering?
Do I get to use that time again? Is it for me?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very common question that I get often, and it's, is there any possibility of using biotechnology for good uses, whatever that might be? We would need to discuss what that is, of course. And the answer is yes, of course. We've always discussed with my students for the last 10 years at least, we've discussed these possibilities. What would you do if you were developing a technology and a cultural development? Because this is not only a technology, but it's actually a cultural development in the same way that the Green Revolution was a cultural development. What would we do with that if we were developing it in a democratic, open, transparent and system? The possibilities are great. The scenarios are beautiful. The utopian visions are fantastic. But that's not the path we followed. We are 35 years into that history that's already happened. And we are so deep in trouble with this that I feel at this point it is, yes, a hypothetical question whether we could use it or not. But the environmental impact, the health impact that we're having with this is so great that I really feel it's time to sit back, you know, and say, do we really want it? And if so, how? And to do that, it's going to take time, because I think the only way we can do that responsibly is by incorporating everybody's opinion into it in a democratic way.
Did you want to add something?
Could I chime
Christopher
in real quick?
Cook? Yes.
On that issue also, there's just this aspect of in whose interest is the technology designed and then propagated? And clearly, so clearly in this case, it's corporate proprietary interests. I mean, if they're really interested in feeding the world, which we can already do in overabundance, and in improving environmental practices in certain cases, which so far hasn't happened, we're using as much or sometimes more pesticides under GMOs than we used in the past. If those were actually the interests, why do they not allow farmers to reuse their seeds? Why do they take the control to survive and subsist away from farmers? And, you know, why do they hide some of their practices, and why do they try to diminish how much the government can examine, you know, their crops, and how much reporting will be done, and all the rest? And so, I think we're in agreement here. I just want to add that point that I think it's fundamentally an aspect of who's controlling the technology and to what ends.
I'm going to shift gears here and ask a question of Bryant Terry, and Michelle Simon may have something to add to this. My question is about obesity. You mentioned it in your opening remarks, and I've read that obesity is the second leading cause of preventable death in this country, second after smoking, and that it's a huge problem, and that it's getting worse. It's increasing. So my question is, what do you think is the root cause of this, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think one of the root causes is the widespread misinformation about the way that foods affect our health. And, you know, just thinking about the population I focus on, young people, billions of dollars, and I think over $10 billion a year are spent marketing the worst foods to young people, marketing foods that are high in fat, high in sugar, highly processed, and low in desirable nutrients that young people need to, you know, grow up and be healthy adults. I mean, everyone needs them, but, you know, the thing is, these are like these unsuspecting, naive young people who are getting these messages from the time that they're born that they should be over-consuming a lot of these foods that are, you know, damaging their health. And so I think what, you know, just thinking about the impetus for me even doing this work and going into working for a citywide agency in New York City and going into different communities around the five boroughs and working with young people and seeing them eating these the worst foods, but then going out into the communities and realizing that, you know, there are two issues at hand. One was the issue of, you know, just ignorance about the relationship between diet and health and how these foods were affecting them. But then there's this major issue of access, and there was just such a lack of access to healthy foods in their communities. So that being said, I think we can talk about creating more access to healthy food in communities, but it has to be coupled with widespread public education about a lot of these issues, you know, but particularly what I'm thinking about is just the relationship between diet and health. And just going back to what Michelle was saying earlier, it, you know, it's very clear, and I was clear when I started doing this work, that lack of access to healthy food in low-income communities is just one symptom of, you know, material deprivation in these communities. When you go to communities with lack of access to food, more than likely there's failing infrastructure, low levels of income, high rates of illiteracy, and I think that it's talking about food allows us to touch on a number of these issues and, you know, thinking about how we can kind of stem the tide of obesity, but also address a number of other issues that many organizations are brilliantly doing across the country now.
I'll just add, you know, the food industry would like to have us believe that the true cause of obesity is not bad food, but lack of exercise. So this is part of the national debate that's going on now, and I want to caution you when you hear someone say, oh, it's, you know, couch potato Americans that's really the problem, it's probably, that message is probably coming from the food industry. or sadly enough, it may be coming from the federal government, because more and more the federal government is adopting the food industry line that it's really exercise that's the problem. And there's no question that we all need to be exercising more. I cop to that. But the data actually shows that physical activity has been fairly constant over the past several decades, whereas the amount of calories that we produce in this country has gone up, and in particular, processed food consumption has gone up. And so, you know, I just want to caution people about when we hear this debate, just keep in mind that, you know, it's a lot easier to consume 300 extra calories than it is to burn it off. It'd take you several hours to burn that off. So the other way I look at the obesity question is kind of going back to my opening remarks, which is it's simply another symptom. And I think it's important that we look at public health measures rather than obesity per se, because there's even some data to suggest that obesity as a public health concern is being exaggerated. So I like to talk about the actual health outcomes, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, that we know are associated with poor diet. And there's also stigma attached when we use the term obesity. And we already have a huge problem with weight bias in this country. We have, you know, all this kind of schizophrenic activity around, you know, promoting unhealthy food while also having wafer-thin models, et cetera. So I like to keep away from talking about obesity, recognizing it is a serious health concern, but sticking to the health outcomes and, again, the larger picture.
Thank you. My next question is about another thing that I've seen in the news lately, which is labor issues in agriculture. There have been stories about the shortage of labor, particularly in California, on fruit orchards, and you hear about fruit falling to the ground unpicked, and particularly a shortage of short-term labor. What is your perspective on this shortage? I don't know who's the best person to answer this question. Anyone?
I don't think
it would be me.
No.
I'll start anyway, and then there's a lot to say about labor, and not much is really said about it, actually. I think on the immigration front, you know, bypassing the very obvious sort of racist zealotry that goes into this anti-immigration push, you know, you have to look at the position that these folks are in, the economic desperation that drives them here to begin with, which is propelled in part by U.S. policies such as NAFTA, which are eroding crop production of staples such as corn in Mexico by flooding U.S. crops into Mexico at cheap rates. So we're creating part of the system that's driving many of these folks up to then come and pick our crops and, in fact, even cut up the animals that have been, as Michelle pointed out, raised on corn. So this is actually this kind of maddening cycle when you look at it. What I think is really important to point out with labor in food is that it's not just a hard job. It's one of the toughest, worst jobs one can do. And it stretches from meat production, meat packing, poultry, very exploited workers in the South working in like catfish processing plants, those kinds of things, and fruits and vegetables, and that we are all connected to a chain of very severe abuse. I've interviewed a lot of these workers and a lot of experts on this and gone to these places, and they're losing limbs, they're losing fingers in machines, they're being permanently crippled by the high-speed processing of up to 90 chickens a minute, and, you know, somewhere, you know, 30, 40, you know, pigs a minute in certain parts of the line. And it's phenomenally fast, and these workers are just hyper-abused. And the important piece of that is not just to point the finger at a bad company and say, oh, you ought to treat your workers better. It's to look at our entire food system is relying on a system of abused, exploited labor. There's no getting around this. And that's part of what has made food relatively cheap in the United States is cheap labor. And it's unsustainable. And especially now that we're seeing this attack on immigration, we're going to see these labor shortages that we're seeing now. And, you know, where are these workers going to go and who's going to produce our food in this country? unless there's a serious discussion about, you know, protecting them through unions, enforcing labor laws. You know, we talk about the spinach case, and they say, well, maybe the workers might have even been relieving themselves in the field, you know, which, you know, sort of raises images of barbarism and the like. Well, the barbarism is on the part of these companies. The state of California had to go out about 6 or 8 months ago and actually tell these farmers that they actually, oh, yeah, had to allow these workers bathroom breaks and water. So, you know, it's a very basic level, and these are literally the sweatshops that produce our food, and it's a grim story, but it has to be told, and it has to be seen as part of our overall food equation, unfortunately.
One thing that often comes up when discussing labor issues is about costs. Any farmer will say, well, I'd like to pay my workers more, but I just can't afford to, and you all want cheap food. And I've heard that we in the United States pay a smaller percentage of our income for food than just about any other country in the world. Yet, I hear even people of quite sufficient means complaining that good quality, sustainably grown, healthy, fresh food is too expensive. On the other hand, the food that's really cheap is often fairly deficient nutritionally. So what's your perspective on this cost of food issue?
Well, I just want to say that I think the problem is that there's this illusion of cheapness and this artificial cheapness that we get with industrial food. And, you know, because the government is paying big subsidies to support fast food and industrial food, it is less expensive, you know, seemingly. But when we think about, and you know, naturally, if those same type of supports were going to small local farmers, they could sell their food a lot cheaper at farmers markets. But when we think about some of the long-term costs, some of the hidden costs, if we think about the cost of, you know, the damage to the environment and the cost of cleanup, when we think about just some of the real kind of emotional and material costs that we pay by having family members that are ill and even being ill ourselves, I think, you know, in the short term, yes, some of that food might be cheaper, but in the long run, it does behoove us to support, you know, some of these other ways of accessing healthy food outside of the conventional grocery stores and even some of the corporate health food stores. That being said, you know, what does that mean for people who are looking for inexpensive healthy food immediately? I think it's about, one, creating more access, and once again, educating people about the ways of accessing it and the importance of accessing it. So whether it be farmers markets, farm stands, food co-ops, local community gardens, locally driven, locally owned solutions to these issues that are producing food for people living in communities, I think will ultimately help to make it cheaper and also educate people about the importance of eating it.
I'll just add that I think the way I usually answer that question is that people who have the means do have some responsibility to pay the true cost of food. So when I shop at my local farmer's market and I see that the fresh local tomatoes are $3 a pound, and I go, oh, gosh, that's a lot more than I'd pay at Safeway. Well, yes, and it's worth it, and, of course, it tastes a lot better, and I'm supporting my local farmer, and I feel good about that. Brian's right. Of course, we need to work on access for those people who can't afford it. And I usually say, I'd like to see the food justice movement link arms with the living wage people. So we can't look at any of these issues in isolation, right? I mean, economic justice crosses many issues. And we need to work to give people a living wage so they can also afford the food that the rest of us are able to.
Can I say something?
Yes, please, Ignacio.
I think it's really surprising to see how few people know that this country had food riots not too long ago, when people were actually out on the streets banging pots and pans because they couldn't afford to eat back in the soon after the recession and so on. And I think it was then, again, you know, thinking about the politics that drive this and how central decision-making, policy-making is important in this. It was back then that I think a very central decision was made, never to acknowledge the true value and the true cost of food, to fool us, ourselves, about the true cost. Because that $1 Mac is not really worth $1. It's a lie about the true cost of that meat, of that wheat, of that, you know, all the things that go into it, because of the environmental, the labor, all the water, the dead zone in the mouth of the Mississippi. Is that not a cost that we are having to cover anyway? But we made a decision, again, very centrally, and I say we because I think we're part of that decision-making process, to fool ourselves about the true cost. There is a growing movement among economists to do what's called environmental accounting, where the ledgers actually show the cost in water mining, the cost in soil loss, the cost in human, what they call human capital. It's a very unfortunate term, I think, but the cost in human value. And if we took environmental accounting seriously, I think we would find that we really do need to put food in a much more privileged place in our budget and our lives.
One, Christopher Cook, go ahead.
One final quick note on that. I mean, I think this raises the important issue, which Bryant raised a little bit as well, about subsidies and just public, the role of public policy, and to say, well, something's missing here in this equation. I mean, some of our food is far too expensive for a good chunk of the population, which either doesn't have access to good food, or even if they do, they can't afford it. And so they eat fast food and junk food and whatever's around that budgets can afford and that's present to them in their neighborhoods. And then, some of the food, organics, it may be properly priced, but there are so many people in this country whose wallets are stretched thin by purchasing it. So there's something in this equation, and then we go back to the labor, and the workers aren't paid enough, and the farmers are pinched. What are we going to do? I think this really cries out for a real public policy discussion in this country about something as elemental and important as food to all of us, all members of society, to say, well, how can we fix this equation, and how can public monies be spent, which are already being spent on behalf of large-scale industrial agriculture and corporations, instead be spent on a food system that will, you know, feed poor folks and feed all of us on a sustainable basis and sustain farmers and workers as well.
Thank you. So in about 5 minutes, we're going to start taking audience questions. So please feel free to start lining up at the microphones. And for my last question for the last 5 minutes, I would like to hear from each of you a little bit about what the good news is. We've been talking about a lot of problems, and there are a lot more that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but what is the good news? What can we do? What is being done? So whoever wants to start can start.
Let me start. The good news is that you guys are here, that this is a full room. I think that is really the good news. Your interest in these questions still don't show in the ledgers. They don't show in the GDP. And just like that, around the world, there is an incredible growth of attention, care, worries, and action, very, very significant and real action, to take charge about these questions. The fact that you're here, I think, is the best news, and the fact that you are part of a network of people around the world who are aware of these problems is, I think, great news.
I think equally so to us all being here tonight and all the networks we're part of is the fact that the ideas are there. These are not pie-in-the-sky ideas. These are concrete, real, maybe not politically practical yet, but implementable ideas on how to fix the food system. And there are groups around the country working on these ideas on a local level and national level, like the Community Food Security Coalition, other groups that are trying to get public money very gradually steered toward human interests and smaller scale sustainable agriculture. The models and the ideas are there, and the people are here in increasing numbers. And what we need is to, I think, build that coherent movement around a set of coherent ideas that can get across the country this idea about sustainability for all of us.
I think as bad as things are, things are very hopeful. And what I'm most excited about are the number of community-based organizations working throughout the United States to solve these problems of food insecurity, to build this food justice movement. And I think what's so brilliant is that many of them are tackling a number of problems in one fell swoop by looking at food. And just one local example is the People's Grocery based in West Oakland, where there are 43 liquor stores and one grocery store. And along with their corn patches and community gardens and their mobile market, they are not only increasing access to healthy food in their community, but they're employing young people, they are beautifying the community, and they are, you know, educating people across the country and using this very strong model about how we can have locally driven, locally owned solutions that can change the food system.
Echo some of that. I flew back this afternoon from Vancouver, where I was attending a conference of the Community Food Security Coalition, which was gathering 1,000 people, both from the United States and Canada. This was the first year they did a cross-border conference. And it's quite inspirational to be in a room of 1,000 people all working to change the food system, to improve it, to work on alternative models like farmers markets, community gardens, school-based projects. Schools have become quite a hotbed of activity for improving food. And so I would encourage anybody out there listening who wants to get involved, find out what you can do locally. There are amazing projects going on in every part of the country, not just here in California, but and around the world. So there's definitely many ways to get involved.
Thank you. For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program with LitQuake. And tonight we're talking about the politics of food, what we eat and why it matters. I'm Julie Cummins of the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, and I'm here with Ignacio Chapela, UC Berkeley professor and activist, Christopher D. Cook, award-winning author of Diet for a Dead Planet, Bryant Terry, author of Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen, and Michelle Simon, author of Appetite for Profit. Now, let's go to the audience for questions, and I just wanted to give a quick reminder to please make your question a question and not a statement, because we have a lot of people here in the live audience and on the radio who are really excited to hear what the panelists have to say, so thank you.
Okay, mine will be actually brief, and this is probably directed to Michelle in Appetite for Profit. I haven't read your book yet, but I think that's something I'm going to get on the way out. My question is this. In other industries such as GE, you've got Jeffrey Immelt leading the way with environmental accounting and wants to prove that he can keep people accountable and still do good for the environment and make a profit. Absent leaders like that in the food industry, take it the next level up. They're accountable to shareholders. There are a large concentration of mutual funds that own shares in companies, and there are sustainable mutual funds out there. Can you comment on any of those initiatives or investment strategies of those funds to try and take control of the agenda in the concentrated set of organizations that make up our food system, and whether or not you think there's some viability in taking this from the shareholder level?
Right. Well, there is some activity actually around Coca-Cola, and there is a group active to change Coca-Cola's practices through shareholder initiatives, and actually there has been some limited success in that regard. But to get at your, to go to your question a bit of a different way, I explain in my book how it's fundamentally impossible for food companies to do the right thing and make money. And the reason is that and I'm talking about food companies like McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Kraft, they make money by processing the hell out of food. I mean, there's just no other way of putting it. Okay, they don't make money by selling fresh fruits and vegetables. They don't make money unless they take things from nature, grind them up, package them, you know, it's value-added, marketing, et cetera, and then they make a lot of money from upping the price from what, you know, would be broccoli. Now we have broccoli potato chips, okay? So, you know, when people say to me, well, you know, why can't companies just make healthy food? Well, they can't, because there's no such thing as healthy processed food. And so, you know, I don't have a lot of hope for what you're describing, to be honest with you. I think we need to be looking to the alternative models, to the truly fresh, healthy food through local, sustainable food systems. And, you know, whether shareholder initiatives can have some success, like what I mentioned with Coca-Cola, you know, that's as far as it goes. I don't see Coca-Cola, though. You know, I mean, what can they do? I mean, bottled water is a whole other problem that, you know, we could spend another hour on. So, yeah.
Thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you for your question. Next question.
Chicago and New York are looking at banning trans fats in restaurants. I'm wondering what other kinds of local policy initiatives at the level of city and county governments you think will be effective in shifting the dynamic of what's happening to our food.
Who'd like to take that one? Michelle Simon is nodding her head.
Yeah, I'm very encouraged by the action taken by New York City, which is the Board of Health has announced two initiatives. One is to require restaurants to stop using trans fat, which is an extremely unhealthy, does not exist in nature, ingredient, mostly in cooking oil. And also to require restaurants to post nutrition information, which is something that restaurants have gotten away with not doing for decades. And, you know, we can question whether those are good strategies. Will they work to really improve food? But the point is, it's a local action by a health department, by a major health department in this country. And there are many things that local governments can do. And what's nice about particularly a health department in the realm of policymaking taking action is that it gets around the major obstacles of getting a bill passed, certainly at the federal level and increasingly harder at the state level and even in city government. So I'm very encouraged by the bravery, really, of the Board of Health in New York and the health commissioner on this. And other ideas that have been kicked around for local action include putting limits on fast food restaurants. So, you know, saying no more fast food restaurants in a segment of Oakland, or Oakland in particular, or any city around the country. How about looking at banning toys, for example? I mean, these are things that local governments could do. And so they're still ideas, but they're getting to be talked about in a more serious way. And, you know, we have a long history of local action really being where things start and then bubbling up, and then one city inspires another. And so I'm encouraged by that.
Could I say something about GMOs here in California? There's a very interesting dynamic. I think this is a very, very important area of dynamics. And in the genetic engineering area, a few counties here in the Bay Area have passed resolutions to ban genetic engineering, genetic engineered crops. Vermont and other places in the Northeast, few places have passed that. The fact that it's so important is witnessed by the fact also that there are massive lobbying efforts trying to pass resolutions here in California, as well as already in 16 other states, to ban the state, to ban the local authorities from passing any resolution that has to do with seeds. They never use the word genetic engineering, they never use the word transgenic or GMO, but it's obvious that the intention is to remove that power of local communities. So it's a great, greatly interesting area of tension in politics about food right now. Whether the local, where people are concerned about their environment, internal and external environment, because of course the environment doesn't end at my skin, right? Whether my concern for my own body and my environment can be played out into politics, or whether money, lobbying money, plays a role, is an incredibly interesting dynamic happening.
Christopher Cook.
Also, another promising movement that's been going on the past decade or so is the rise of food policy councils in some localities and cities and even states. And this is a way of really creating a local, civic, public platform for the concept that food should be healthy and sustainable. And it puts the public eye on it. And, you know, they've done things in certain places such as build marketing relationships between farmers and urban areas and create incentives for folks to transition into organic farming. So in Minnesota, we've seen the Minnesota Food Association help over 1,000 farmers transition toward organics, partially by helping them connect up with urban markets. And there are initiatives like this that, in addition to fighting all the bad stuff that we need to fight, can start to try to stitch together local food systems. They don't have to be exclusively local, but they can start to say, well, where is the available land? Where are the farmers who are struggling? Where are the markets, you know, especially in poor areas where people don't even have access to good food? And how can we, you know, create incentives for, you know, small businesses to start up that are actually going to sell this local healthy food to folks at a reasonable rate? So there are a lot of really promising ideas out there like that as well.
Thank you. Back to the public school system again. Low-income kids across the country, some of them eat 80% of their food at school. And I know in San Francisco, we have about $2 for lunch and breakfast combined to spend on food. So I'm wondering what, first of all, you might think an accurate price point would be were we to call our congresspeople and ask them to raise the rates. And also, where you think the best access point is for effecting change there, because as you know, the commodity system is tied up in the corporate farms, and that food comes very cheap, if not free, to the school districts, and so they end up using these highly processed foods.
I don't know quite enough about the economics of school meals, but I certainly know that $2 is not enough. It's interesting, in England, the celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, you might have heard about, has taken on the issue of school meals there. And guess what? He embarrassed the British government enough that they agreed to significantly increase the amount of money going to the school meals. And that has made a tremendous difference. And of course, the question is, well, why can't we do that here? And of course, we can. We just need the political will. And what's really sad about not enough money going to school meals is that this is resulting in schools needing to rely on the junk food and soda being sold through the vending machines, et cetera. And really, it just comes down to values, right? We're not valuing kids enough through education in general, and particularly through food. So, you know, what to do about it? Well, you know, gets back to, I guess, basic politics and lobbying your local Congress people to get them, as angry about it as you obviously are, and we all should be. What are the messages we're sending kids? And particularly, you're right, it's devastating for low-income kids. You know, the system where we have these commodity foods, mostly the high-fat meat and dairy products, which I call sort of the dumping ground of these unhealthy products onto the food assistance programs, and particularly school meals. To a lesser extent, the WIC program, Women's, Infants, and Children. This is a system that is unethical in my mind, and we need to rethink that and place our values in a reorder our values. I don't know how to get there, but I think having the conversation is a good place to start.
I just want to mention that in Berkeley, Ann Cooper is attempting to bring healthier foods into the schools, and I think the website is School Lunch Initiative? SchoolLunchInitiative.org to become more active and get more information around what's being done nationally as well as just across the bridge in Berkeley.
Thanks. Let's take the next question.
This is for Ignacio. I understand that you can grow muscle cells easily in a nutrient bath, and some people are arguing that it won't be too many years before we'll have a diverse protein source without killing animals. Is that possible?
I'm sure it's possible to have hydroponic meat. I don't think I want to buy that hamburger. And truly, I think there are people. There are people who are putting out this utopia of a time when we won't need soil, when all our food will be removed from its connection to the soil and its connection to an open space where sun is the source of energy and so on and so forth. Is it possible? It is possible, and that's what's interesting about it, I think, that we get to choose what type of world we live in. It's not about the impossibility of it. It's not about the deadliness of it. It's about our choice and whether we like it or not. I believe that's really what it's about. So growing hydroponic meat, I don't have time to go through the whole exercise of saying how much energy goes into it, how much, what type of place would that be grown in, a closed building and so on and so forth. What type of problems should we expect out of that hydroponic meat, what type of diseases and so on. So you can imagine a world with a lot of problems, and yeah, that problem would be solved. It probably would be cheaper. But do we want it? To me, that is the question. What do we want?
Thank you.
This is for Michelle Simon. Can you help me understand the legal rationale for the non-GMO producers, the court's ruling against them when they've been found with GMO seed and plants in their fields, which namely have been brought about through birds and wind and water carrying?
You know what? I'm a lawyer, but that's not my area of expertise, so I'm going to pass this one down the line.
Treachery here. I'm not a lawyer either. the one thing I can say is that part of their, quote, rationale was that it's proprietary, it's corporate property. These seeds are company property, and they ended up on somebody else's land. They, this company Monsanto, and they're not even alone in this, but they're the prominent force, hired Pinkerton spies to go on to this farmer, Percy Schmeiser, the most well-known victim of this in Canada, go onto his land and allegedly, anyway, find their seeds on his land, and then sue him for something that he never wanted to begin with, because, as Ignacio can explain in much more detail, these seeds blow through the wind and rapidly can infect another farmer's crop downwind. And, suddenly you're left with, well, who can prove what brought them there? Was it the wind? Was it the farmer? Was it the company? Who was it? And yet this farmer who clearly doesn't want these things and who has now his non-GMO status completely altered and tainted by this corporate property is the one being sued instead of in the reverse. But.
I'm not a lawyer either, but that's why I can talk. I do know a lawyer down the street here at Stanford who about, it was probably 15 years ago, John Barton, a very well known scholar of law, especially property rights on technology. He was talking about this problem, and I remember him saying the attempt at using patents on life is going to fall flat on its face. And we are seeing this problem. In the famous Golden Rice case, there are more than 50 patents crossing over this poor little seed to the point where nobody dares to put the seed in the ground, lest they be sued by the other 50 or 49 people. So it's a massive, massive exercise, I think, in futility, in using a system that was created for the production of machines about 200 years ago and applying it to something that really should not be restricted to that type of ownership.
So we've only got a few minutes left. Thank you for your question. Let's take the next one.
Hi, this question is for Professor Chappella. So in the interest of improving public health, we iodize our salt, we add fluoride to our water to prevent cavities. So if we can use biotechnology to similarly, through science, enrich our crops in such a way that makes them healthier, such that we can address some of the problems that the panel discussed tonight regarding affordable access to nutritious food, why is that a bad thing?
Yeah, I think we talked about that before. Thank you for the question. And I would never say that's a bad thing. We are not there. I think the standard of proof at this point for these technologies of something that's going to be released into the public environment without any real benefit, because at this point, after 35 years of trying, we really haven't come up with anything of that level of benefit as fluorinating the water or that type of public health result. I think at this point the level of proof or the standard of proof should be much higher, and we should be a lot more careful about something that will be distributed widespread in the public environment.
Okay, next question.
This is for Christopher Cook or anyone else who wants to answer. You've talked about changes on the local level with
local governments and institutions, but we have an opportunity coming up next year with the agriculture bill. What changes would you like to see the federal government make?
I'm really glad you asked that. The Farm Bill is a critical area for activists and just the public in general to really weigh in on how our food is made and marketed and such. And just to give you a quick sketch, $25 billion in taxpayer money right now goes predominantly to large-scale agriculture. The top 70% of all these funds going to the top 10% of farmers, and it basically operates as a pass-through to corporations that then process their food that they've obtained at these very cheap rates. And I talk about this more in the book, but it's a really key area where we can say, well, these are taxpayer dollars that go into a system that's environmentally destructive, pesticide-intensive, creates a system of processed food through corporate controls. And so I would really like to see a national discussion about these issues, both, you know, directly through national lobbying efforts, which are starting to happen as the Farm Bill, which is in the process of now being, negotiated, we hope it really does get negotiated, gets done around the country in discussions. But more broadly, having a national discussion about where is our money going? And you know, so I would like to see a transition in those funds over time, not overnight, but over time, toward a different model, which is small and medium-sized, sustainable agriculture, organic production, but also sustainable organics that's not on a large scale for Walmart and Safeway. And we're not going to get there overnight, and I'm not talking anyway about suddenly pulling the rug out from under subsidy recipients right now who are using pesticides. We're talking about what are the national priorities and where does our money go, and let's start to move that money in a different direction. And it can be done. I mean, people pointed out our current food system is a result of a history of these subsidies, and so it can be rewritten if we have enough of a movement to do that.
Okay, it looks like those are all the questions that we have time for right now, unfortunately. I'm sorry. Let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum and LitQuake is adjourned.